You are listening to Nothing to See Here, a program of experimental spoken word radio produced by David Clark. This episode is entitled Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud. Let me introduce myself. My name is Mud, and this is a show about mud. Or more specifically, this is a show about nature and culture.
Wallowing in the mud.
But let's start with mud.
Mud is dirty. It is nature's stain on our civilized cleanliness.
But maybe mud can also be healing and natural.
Mud pack.
I want to talk about nature and culture and the natural and how we embrace and separate ourselves from the natural dirty world. This is about how the word mud is being inserted into this gap between nature and culture. It's about trying to read the word mud for its connotations and its contradictions. And to move the word mud backwards and forwards across history to see what it can tell us about living. This is a talk about mud, mud, glorious mud.
Mud, mud, glorious mud. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me, follow, down to the hollow, and there let us wallow in glorious mud, mud. Glorious mud, and there let us wallow in glorious mud, mud, glorious mud, glorious mud, mud, glorious mud, glorious mud, mud, glorious mud, glorious mud.
But first, let's talk about baseball and cricket. We can see the difference between English and American attitudes towards the natural landscape by looking at how they play bat and ball games. Baseball, for instance, is played in a park where, much like the American obsession with the lawn, nature is tamed and controlled. Americans tend to like a level playing field, that is, neutral conditions where an individual player's skill can be tested. Cricket, by contrast, is played on a field, and instead of being thrown directly through the air, the cricket ball is bounced on a flat, prepared surface called the wicket. The condition of this wicket and the weather deeply affects the way that the game is played. This means that players with different skills will have different advantages and disadvantages in different conditions. For instance, in overcast conditions, swing bowlers are able to get more movement from the ball when it is bounced off the pitch, whereas the dry conditions of a cricket wicket will help spin bowlers who are exploiting the cracks in the surface of the pitch. A cricket game, therefore, is intimately connected to the place where the game is being played. In the cricket game pre-show, you'll often see a shot where the camera zooms in to examine the condition of the surface of the wicket, with commentators describing whether it is dry or sticky, or if there's cracks or perhaps a little grass growing on the pitch. They attend to the pitch with the poetic attention of a wine sommelier. There is also a big difference between how the ball is used in cricket and baseball. In baseball, the ball is expected to be the same for every pitch. In a professional game, every time the ball is hit or gets lost in the crowd, it is replaced. This means that hundreds of balls are used in an average baseball game. And over the course of a major league season, perhaps a million baseballs would be used. In cricket, however, the wear and tear on the ball is part of the game. If a ball is hit out of the stadium, play is interrupted while somebody goes to retrieve it. Only very reluctantly will somebody trot out with a selection of spare balls, each worn down to different degrees, when a ball is completely lost. The condition of the ball in cricket affects how fast bowlers or spin bowlers are able to play and create different challenges for the batsman. The bowlers are permitted to rub the ball, which affects how the ball will move off the wicket, but there's a strong penalty for deliberately tampering with the condition of the ball. And of course, cricket has a reputation of being an honorable game, as captured by the phrase, "That's not cricket." And in fact, players can be fined or banned for bringing the game of cricket into disrepute. Recently, a scandal consumed Australian cricket after a television crew with a good zoom lens showed an Australian fielder tampering with a ball using a hidden piece of sandpaper in his trousers. The Australian captain, Stephen Smith, who was also a world top-ranked batsman, was banned from cricket for a year for this incident.
To all of my teammates, to fans of cricket all over the world, and to all Australians who are disappointed and angry, I'm sorry. I made a serious error of judgment, and I now understand the consequences. It was a failure of leadership, of my leadership. I'll do everything I can.
The scandal that ensued dominated Australian headlines for weeks, and even the Australian Prime Minister chimed in. Some called it Australia's Watergate. For Captain Steve Smith, we could say his name was
Mud. Mud. Glorious Mud. Glorious Mud. Mud. Glorious Mud. Glorious Mud. Mud. Glorious Mud. Glorious Mud.
In baseball, the name most associated with Mud is Lana Blackburn. He was an American third base coach who worked in the major leagues in the 1930s. He is known for the popular Lana Blackburn baseball rubbing mud. A new baseball has a glossy surface that is hard for the pitcher to grip. In the early days of baseball, players used many different ways to try and break down this glossy surface, including tobacco juice, shoe polish, or even just dirt from the baseball field. But it was Lana Blackburn who found the perfect substance, mud from the shores of the Delaware River. Since then, Lana Blackburn baseball rubbing mud has been used by almost every major baseball team in the U.S., where it would be smeared on about a million baseballs every year. Blackburn and his family, who inherited his business, kept the exact location of this mud secret, although rumor has it that it came from somewhere near where Blackburn grew up, in Palmyra, New Jersey. Palmyra, New Jersey was settled by Swedes in the late 17th century. It was initially known as Texas, but then a local landowner with a strong interest in ancient history convinced the railroad to rename the town Palmyra after the ancient trading center in modern-day Syria. Palmyra in Syria is an ancient oasis city that features some of the most remarkable historic sites in the Middle East. It has been at the center of an intense conflict in the Syrian civil war, particularly after it was occupied by ISIL in 2015. There are many ancient historical sites that were deliberately destroyed by a special unit of ISIL that had selected these cultural sites for demolition. They justified their actions through an extremist interpretation of Salafism that places a great importance on eliminating polytheism. The idea was to purge the landscape of its history, leaving only a single, unambiguous cultural meaning amidst the pluralism of modern culture.
So you start in kind of a lay start.
Usually you do two basics.
You have like a sloper with a little crack.
And then an inside turn.
And you kind of pinch it.
Followed by a crossbody lead double inside turn.
With your right foot high.
And then
you do this big move.
From there you go directly into a 360.
Where you lock off and pull.
And then a back break.
Throw and barely catch this crimp.
And then
you shuffle your foot over onto this like kind of slopey foothold.
Or the follow.
And then you go do like a big pop move.
Or the follow will...
And catch this...
will hijack.
Gascoigne with like two fingers.
While you're in the back break.
Then roll in.
And then
you go to another Gascoigne.
When she's done hijacking, then...
So double Gascoigne.
You meet back together and then go back into the basics.
And then you shuffle your feet.
Double turn.
And I haven't done this move yet.
Double turn.
But I think you put all your weight, so you create a lot of tension with your right foot hold.
Repeat.
And your left hand. So that you can release the right hand.
You have to have...
And then you do kind of a big move up to this other crimp.
Following is like this magical
and then
thing.
Throw out to this arete sloper.
Like you just...
And then top out.
Do it. You don't. You're not supposed to think about it.
The word mud entered the lexicon of the internet age as an anacronym for the multi-user dimension or a multi-user dungeon. This mud is an early version of a digital space where multiple players or users interact using text-based interactions. MUDs originally gained popularity as a way to play games online, but then they became a way of facilitating other social interactions in virtual space, such as classrooms and chat rooms. In studies that date back to the 1990s, the American sociologist Sherry Turkle has claimed that today's youth are increasingly facing problems with identity and social connection through the lack of real-world contact they have in these virtual environments. The multi-user dimension is a non-space that takes us very far away from the nature of fields and parks where games like cricket and baseball are played.
Glorious mud. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me, follow. Down to the hollow.
So it's like six really hard moves in a row.
If you're thinking about it too hard, then it's really easy to backlead.
So like each individual move,
which is trying to lead as a follow,
feels doable, but the idea of like linking them all,
which is bad. You're supposed to be fully in the moment.
Seems brutal.
Fully prepared.
So it's in this huge rock slide of like limestone. So the rock is like relatively new,
or
at least it's not only been exposed to the air for like
anything that the lead
100 years.
Will
so there's not a lot of like lichen, and it's very gray rock.
Present to you.
It's limestone,
or lead you into.
Sometimes there's like
coral, but also
from like what used to be an ocean, I guess.
At the same time, like still connected to the music and still sort of your own dancer.
Kim Jones is a performance artist from Los Angeles, who is primarily known for his alter ego, the Mudman. The Mudman appears on city streets, subways, galleries, and in museums, caked in mud and wearing a cumbersome lattice structure of sticks on his back. This is a costume derived from the camouflage that Jones would have used when he served as a soldier in the Vietnam War. The Mudman is, for Jones, a kind of shaman-like figure who embraces mud as a kind of healing process and relives the trauma of his wartime experiences through the performance. For years, Jones as the Mudman has been making a series of large drawings based on the childhood game of tanks. This is a game where the player draws little tanks on a piece of paper and then uses the flick of the pencil to shoot them at enemy tanks. The player erases the tanks when they are destroyed or when they move throughout the landscape. In the Mudman's large drawings, red and blue armies have been fighting an imaginary war for decades. You can see in the drawings a palimpsest of years of erased marks that describe the extensive and futile war that is sustained over years and years by the artist's imagination.
Mud, 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 mud.
This phrase, "his name is Mud," is said to trace back to Dr. Samuel Mud, the doctor who treated the broken leg of Abraham Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth, who was on the run after his shooting of Lincoln in 1865. Although Mud was a slave-owning tobacco farmer with sympathies for Booth and his cause, he was never really certain about whether he was part of the conspiracy or even knew about the assassination when he treated Booth. After the roundup and the trial, he was imprisoned and just narrowly avoided the death penalty. Years later, he was pardoned, but his reputation was forever soiled. In the 1952 Chuck Jones directed cartoon Operation Rabbit, we find Bugs Bunny coming up against Wile E. Coyote.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Wile E. Coyote. Genius. You are a rabbit, and I am going to eat you for supper.
With the inevitable failed attempts to capture Bugs Bunny, Wile E. Coyote admits defeat. He returns to Bugs Bunny to say,
"Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Mud."
And remember, Mud spelled backwards is dumb.
Perhaps we don't get this joke anymore, but in 1952, everybody would have known that this was a parody of the popular slogan of the laxative company, Seroton.
Remember, as you get older, your system tends to slow down, become sluggish, and the laxative you're using may no longer be best for you. Try Seroton, the all-vegetable laxative aid especially made for folks over 35. Taken daily, Seroton gets you regular and keeps you regular. Remember, when you read Seroton backwards, it spells nature's.
Seroton was a laxative that was advertised widely from the 1930s through to the 1960s. Its biggest selling point was that it was a natural product to distinguish itself from other laxatives that stimulated the colon with chemicals. Another parody of Seroton from the time was recorded by Red Ingle, who is known for his parody records with Spike Jonze. Seroton Yob, which is Nature Boy spelled backwards, was a hillbilly parody of the jazz standard made popular by Nat King Cole. It plays with the double meaning of the word backwards, as both the cliche of the backwards hillbilly, as well as the read it backwards slogan for Seroton laxatives. There is something strange about reading things backwards. Perhaps even stranger is this idea of what nature backwards is. It's a strange idea that reading words backwards implies an opposite meaning. Is nature just culture backwards? The idea that reading words backwards implies an opposite meaning might be linked to the ideas of occultism and Satanism through the English eccentric Aleister Crowley. The popular press at the time called him the wickedest man in the world. He was a true believer in magic, and he would dedicate himself to months-long ceremonies and rituals in his Loch Ness retreat, that incidentally was eventually bought by Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin many years later. He wrote, "If you want to use black magic, you should try and learn how to think and speak backwards." Crowley's idea of speaking backwards as a kind of black magic perhaps contributed to the widespread idea that rock musicians used reversed sounds to hide satanic messages in their records. The hysteria peaked in 1983, when, with pressure from Christian groups, legislation was passed by the California State Assembly, which made it illegal to distribute such records without a sticker that stated, "Warning, this record contains backward masking, which may be perceptible at a subliminal level when the record is played forward." Nature Boy was a breakout hit that helped introduce Nat King Cole to a wider audience. It has since gone on to become a jazz standard, and also the prototype of a theme of song that romanticizes the theme of nature, inspiring such songs as Mother Nature's Son, written by Paul McCartney for the White Album. It also started the career of the eccentric songwriter Eden Abbez. The song Nature Boy was in many ways an autobiographical song. Abbez was born George McGrew, but adapted the name Eden Abbez when he came to Los Angeles in 1941. He was playing piano at a small health food store on Laurel Canyon Boulevard when he was exposed to the philosophies of Naturemensch and Lebensreform. Their followers, who are known as Nature Boys, wore long hair and beards and ate only raw fruits and vegetables. Abbez adopted the philosophy and became a hippie long before the hippie movement began. He would sleep outside, live on fruits and nuts and vegetables, and famously lived on $3 a week. The story of how Abbez got his song into the hands of one of the top black singers in the world is quite interesting. In 1947, Abbez went to the Lincoln Theater in Los Angeles, known as the West Coast Apollo, and approached Nat King Cole's manager backstage, asking him to show his tattered copy of Nature Boy to Cole. But his pleas were ignored, and so Abbez left the sheet music with Cole's valet. Cole eventually saw the song, loved it, and began playing it for live audiences, to much acclaim. Irvin Berlin heard it and offered to buy the track from Cole, but Cole had decided to record it for himself. He, however, needed the permission of Abbez to release the single, and he couldn't find him. Finally, Abbez was discovered living under the first L in the Hollywood sign in the Hollywood Hills. Abbez became the focus of a media frenzy when Nature Boy shot to number one on the Billboard charts during the summer of 1948. He began a career writing more songs and even recording his own strange, exotic records. He became an inspiration for the hippie movement that would emerge in the late 1960s. Abbez also acknowledged that Nature Boy was about another pioneer of the hippie lifestyle, a German-born American named William Frederick Pester. Known as the Hermit of Palm Springs, Pester had lived in a small hut that became a popular tourist destination in the 1920s. It was thought that in the 1920s, Pester was probably the most photographed man in California. He was described as a short, slim man with long hair, almost naked, and with blue eyes full of distance, gentle and even likable in his mild way. He was the most notable link between the German Lebensreform movement and the Back to the Land movement of the 1960s. the late 19th century and the early 20th century, hundreds of groups emerged across Germany dedicated to ideas such as ecology and organic farming, vegetarianism, naturalism, and abstinence from alcohol and tobacco. Some of the groups were made up of socialists, some were apolitical, and some were right-wing and nationalist in outlook. The Lebensreform movement emphasized the goodness of nature and decried harms caused to nature by industrialization. It also emphasized the importance of the whole person, mind and body, and the goodness of the old ways. The Lebensreform movement had a wide-ranging influence on the 20th century, including on contemporary environmental movements, the organic food movement, fad diets, hippies, and the back to the land movements. Another stream, however, of the Lebensreform movement gradually became the blood and soil part of Nazi ideology in the 1930s.
It's in there. You can see like little shells and like
it's
really like chossy.
It's like it's always a challenge.
Loose rock whenever it's the coral rock.
You have to have,
and it's lots of crimps and edges, and
you have to be able to know your steps and know
weird slopers. Not very good texture, like it's
timing and musicality.
Got a little bit of texture, but it doesn't like eat up your skin that much.
But you also need be able to let that go to a certain extent.
And then split in the middle, like the name.
And just sort of flow.
Has this like huge crack in the middle where the rock is like.
And respond.
Split in two.
And listen with your whole body.
And the line split in the middle is like to the right of it. And it just goes straight up.
It's magical. It's like the best feeling I know when it's going well. And when you're not doing very well at it, it feels terrible.
So nature and culture. Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
Nature is what is. Culture is what people think about nature.
Yeah. Does nature fall in the forest if you don't have culture to tell you about it?
I like that one. I'm going to use it.
You have been listening to Nothing to See Here. This program, entitled Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud, was written and produced by David Clark. Caitlin Kabernick was the dancer, and Devin Chambers was the climber. The voice of Mud was by David Clark. Sound design and mixing were by David Clark, with piano by Ross Unger. In the show, you heard music sampled from Flanders and Swan, Red Ingle, and Nature Boy by Eden Abbez. Thanks to Sue Iplikley, Bartu Kutner, and Carmen Bellinger for their contributions.